I want to return again this morning to another proverb. As I put my things out, I realized I forgot my storybook, the Book of Virtues. I had a story chosen. I'll see how I can do on it to begin without the words. An old man died, leaving his poor widow with very little. So she moved in with her son and his wife and their little daughter. Day by day, her sight decreased, her hearing grew worse, and the shakes began. At the table, she would often spill the peas out of the spoon and clank things together and even spilled the milk once. So the husband and wife decided this was intolerable to have such a thing at their table. So they found a little table and put it next to the bread cupboard over in the corner, found a chair, and from then on that's where his mother ate her meals. And as she would sit there with tears in her eyes and watch them eat, very little did they pass her way but scoldings for her klutziness or for her spills. Then one day, the little daughter was building with the building blocks in the kitchen. And the father said, "What are you building, sweetheart?" She says, "A table for you and mommy when you get old." As the parents sat in quietness and tears came, they quickly went over to the mother and took her hand and guided her back to the table where she belonged. And they never complained anymore when there was a spill or a clang at the table. Please turn with me to Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24, we're going to look at verse 11 and 12. Let me say right from the onset, this week has been a week. If you've listened to your radio, if you've had any thoughts of pro-life, this week has been a busy week with those thoughts. And this verse, or these verses, I think epitomize that movement. But I don't want these verses or this Sunday school to turn into a pro-life call to arms necessarily. If it becomes that, that's fine. If that's where you would focus, that's fine. But I don't want this verse to be lost only to that cause. I think it's much broader than that, and I hope that we can draw that out. So I say that from the onset, even though there might be some thoughts and some emphasis that we speak of. Proverbs 24, verse 11 and 12. Deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If you say, "See, we did not know this," does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work? As I thought about these verses, I thought, where might their foundations lie? And where might we go to find the foundations for these verses? And please turn back to Genesis. Anyone thinking with me? It's a story. Can anyone think of a story that might be a foundation for these verses? Cain and Abel. Very good. You're right with me. You're even ahead of me. Genesis chapter 4. Can you read that for us, Matt? I'd have you read 1 through 12.
And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And she again bare his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time it came to pass that Cain brought up the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with Abel his brother. And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth.
So there's that pertinent question that Cain asks God, Am I my brother's keeper? And what was the answer? Are we given an answer in this text? What would you say the answer is? Yes. How can we deduce that from this text? Because it's not given to us. Because he was cursed. He was called into account, you might say, for his question. Am I my brother's keeper? The question or the answer is loud, isn't it? Yes, you are. His blood is crying out to me. I have heard it, and you will be cursed for your lack of being your brother's keeper, for your anger, for your wrath, and even for trying to cover this thing. So there's an Old Testament foundation text, I would say, for this thought of delivering those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. We have an obligation to our brother. Now, let's think about New Testament. Who can think of a New Testament foundation stone that we could easily build on? Any stories, thoughts, or statements of Jesus that come to mind? The Good Samaritan. You folks are way ahead of me this morning. Okay, let's turn to that. I want us to build a good foundation. Otherwise, we might look at a verse like this and frankly, discount it. Go to Luke 10. And if we've got some handouts. I'm not sure who had those. Could you hand those out while we're looking up Luke 10? Aaron, could you read Luke 10 for us? Let's read 25 through 37. And remember what the question is. The question is, who is my neighbor? All right?
And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, "Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? What is your reading of it?" So he answered and said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered rightly. Do this and you will live." But he wanted to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Then Jesus answered and said, "A certain man went down from Jerusalem and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him in the back, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a certain priest came down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. And he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said to him, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you.' So which of these three do you think was the neighbor to him who fell among the thieves?" And he said, "He who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said, "Go and do likewise."
If you catch that last statement, it propels it from the story forward to 2007. So you don't miss it. It's a word to each of us: go and do likewise. Now before, I've copied 2 commentators on this text that really blew the scope wide open. But before we go there, again, I'd like to have you thinking so that we're just not provided the answers. When you look at Proverbs 24, verses 11 and 12, I think, in this week, abortion maybe jumps to our minds. But let's go past that. What else do you think might fit into this category? Abortion is so evident in our day. Andy.
As you read that story, I thought of my grandmother.
Put that on my paper, Andy. I think, again, the elderly in our day. Not euthanasia comes into focus, and we could, put that as a direct, but I would even say even shy of euthanasia. The last time you've been to a old people's home, and I appreciate the ladies who are bringing our young girls, because that is a place that we would go where Deb's grandma was, and that place would rip my heart out. And I think it applies to this verse in some way, shape, or form. Anyone else? Brian. Good. We'll put that right at the top. Bridges will expand that for us. Thank you. How about socially? These proverbs are written for, in the beginning, to training princes. Correct? It was Solomon's word to his sons. And he wanted the basics of this life and the necessities of this life to be trained into them, that they have a full orb as to how they were to rule and what their sense of right and wrong and just and unjust should be. So it's a call to them. So think socially. I don't think we should be afraid to think socially. Think about our society. Let's keep going on this. I think it goes much deeper.
Persecuted and enslaved.
Good. Now we're thinking more globally, aren't we? But we could even think closer to home on that, correct? Enslaved, let's just put it downtrodden. That can be here in Holland, I believe. Okay, not just globally, but certainly globally. Brian?
AIDS patients, even homosexual and otherwise.
Okay. How can we categorize that?
Morally ill.
I don't know how to spell stigmatize. You know what I'm saying when I say stigmatized? People that we quickly... pushed aside. And that can be... that can be for many different reasons, can't it? That can be as simple as an ear being like this to a school child, right? Or a nose like this. Or you name it, right? That's all it takes in our society is one flaw. One physical flaw. And I think this verse begins to touch them, doesn't it? Deliver them. Deliver them. Anyone else come to mind? Yes, Josh.
Poor, the unemployed, and homeless.
Good. We could leave them in the downtrodden, but let's just put them up here. Again, how easily we push them aside. And again, I think sometimes it can be even good biblical thinking that allows us to do this. Well, if they were diligent... Right? It's their own sin. Did you have one, Paul? Good. The Bible certainly gives us that one clearly. Yes, Dave.
Maybe under downtrodden, suicidal, very depressed people.
Mentally ill. Again, in our society, we might go, oh boy, we don't want to go there. Distressed. Yes. Good. Handicapped. I'll just leave that pushed aside because they have a defect. So we push them aside. I even thought of this one. How about single mom? How about widow? How about single dad? Didn't quite fit. How about orphan? And in that category, I think we should even put, how about children of a single mom? Children of a single dad. The phrase that grabs me in the NAS, and if you were to underline a couple of things in this verse for your memory, there's two things. The first word needs to be put in bold. It's the call to action. It's deliver. It's the thrust of this text. Deliver. What does deliver mean? Throw some. What comes to your mind when you think of deliver?
Freedom.
Freedom. Good. To set them free from whatever it is, right? From whatever oppression. From whatever holds them.
to release them from being stigmatized. How do we do that? How would we do that? Reach out to them. Biblically speaking, New Testament speaking, it's a word that's characterized of Christ. Look it up in your concordance. It's the word, and moved with compassion. Compassion is the word that we need if we're going to meet these. Compassion is the word that I think of. So the deliver is in bold, but then there's that statement. And compassion is the word that comes to mind. Oh, hold them back. Can you see that visually? It's a man, right? Or a woman. They're standing in the way. They're doing, it's a load, right? Oh, hold them back. You can see their arms are full. And that person who's stepped forward, who's stood alongside that one who's been pushed aside, even in the playground, or in the study hall, or in the cafeteria, it's the one who comes alongside, that has enough compassion to come alongside, who will hold back the broken heart of the person, right? Who'll be willing to bear that broken heart and to work, not just once, right? It might be brave to do it once in the cafeteria, but would you dare to do it the second day and the third day? Would you dare to invite them to the ball game to sit with you? I think I've mentioned to you often, right back there in the factory in Lakewood when I worked there in Prince days, there was a young man who came on board, and he very quickly became the one that everyone loved to have come to the party, because when he got a little alcohol in him, he evidently lost all restraint. That was the joke around the lunch table on Monday morning. And I think of this text. Oh, hold them back. Right? Who will step forward to that man? Because why did he go there? He wanted a friend. Let's look at these thoughts. Matthew Henry is on your left. It's the narrow book. Charles Bridges is on your right. Matthew Henry usually sticks more, you might say, with the practical. I think Charles Bridges often goes to the spiritual. And that's why I like these two side by side. Often they'll give different thoughts and different helps. Let's let, like I say in our home, Pastor Henry open up this text for us. Here is first a great duty required of us, and that is to appear for the relief of oppressed innocency. If we see the lives or livelihoods of any in danger of being taken away unjustly, we ought to bestir ourselves all we can to save them by disproving the false accusations on which they are condemned, and seeking out proofs of their innocence. When I read this to my kids on Thursday, I said, you know, one of the most beautiful things, and it takes money to buy it, that's placed in the Lakeshore Pregnancy Center on River Avenue, that does this very thing, it's an ultrasound machine. Every pregnancy center in this country needs an ultrasound machine. It disproves the lie that the baby is not a baby. It's a beautiful machine, a useful machine, a needed machine, because it disproves the false accusations on which they are condemned. I would interject here on Thursday night, there were some things thrown out that shocked me. We know the 1.2 million babies, 47 million since 1973, and that, by the way, is recorded. Okay? We won't even touch RU486. We won't touch all of those that are not recorded for many different purposes. But those are recorded, honestly recorded abortions. 47 million. He was an international life person, you might say. On the globe last year, we killed 50 million babies. My impression was that America was the wicked, that we were the ones leading the way, and we have led the way in many ways, but now we've spread it, and we put it in the hands of the UN. Planned Parenthood is worldwide, and it's funded heavily by the UN. It's called population control. And we, in America, were actually number 26, or no, 35 on the list. 35 on the list of countries. Number one was Vietnam. Of every 1,000 women, 82 or 88 women had abortions. And then it trickled down on the chart. China was 26 women per 1,000. America was 22 women per 1,000. Oh, hold them back. Which also means, by the way, as I was thinking about this morning, if we have had 47 million abortions since 1973, how many women are walking around? Maybe not 47 million. Maybe several of them have had, and I know that's the case, especially in some sectors, they'll have 2 and 3 and 4. But can we safely say 20 or 30 million women are walking around with this in their hearts? Oh, hold them back. Let's go back to Pastor Henry. Though the persons be not such as we are under any particular obligation to, in other words, they might not be a friend or a family member or a church member, we must help them out of a general zeal for justice. I think, again, the foundation there is when you hear God say, the voice of Abel's blood cries out to me from the ground. Anytime justice is not done in our society, be it on whatever level, whatever sector, we who are image bearers of God, who have a sense of justice planted in our hearts, must step forward. If any be set upon by force and violence, and it be in our power to rescue them, we ought to do it. Again, I remember before this last election, standing with maybe a 65-year-old man in my shop, and I happened to have a DeVos sign in the front. Not that I thought DeVos was perfect, but I know the alternative. And he felt he needed to correct me on that. Okay? He said, you know how much money he makes? And he had it down, he and a bunch of guys, they had it down to what he got as a paycheck every week. Now that's a great way to rot the average guy right out, isn't it? Throw that around, right? He just wants to be president. Okay? I said, I'm not going to defend him in any way. I don't think that's needed, but I will ask this. Do you realize what partial birth abortion is? He said, do you know about the knife-like scissors that's put into the back of the skull because they're partially birthed? Do you know that our representatives and our senators in Michigan sent a bill to Granholm's desk that would stop that barbaric act in our state? And do you know what she did? I said, I don't care what other things she says or doesn't say. That is unacceptable. And if we can't do better than that, then we better go home. I don't know. 65-year-old man. A delightful man. Why this ignorance? It's a chosen ignorance. Many of these are chosen ignorance. And that's why verse 12 hits home of our thing, right? If you say we did not know this, it can only be because you've chosen to try to not to know it or to conveniently forget it, I think is what Bridges says coming up. It's not possible. We cannot do this. Nay, if we say through ignorance, exposing themselves to danger or falling in distress, if we see any through ignorance, exposing themselves to danger. Again, I look at these little phrases, and we could spend a lot of time on each of these phrases. If we see any through ignorance, exposing themselves to danger. Anybody ignorant around you at work? Any young man in college who's messing around with a girl? Ignorant? You think of the examples. We live, we function around ignorant people. Yes, Tom.
You were talking about deliverance and really didn't touch on it here, but in Proverbs 2, a deliverance is talking about to deliver you from the adulterous woman. And it talks in the context of Proverbs 24, a deliverance from death. And Proverbs 7 says, he goeth after her like an ox to the slaughter. And by implanting wisdom, we are delivering the young man.
So with that in mind, beautifully said, Tom, can any of us say, I did not know this? I am shocked. I've got a new man working with me. He goes to church. He's a fine young man so far. I'm thrilled so far. 22 years old. He has, just in several different conversations and several different things said, at one point, I took out Romans and read Romans 13 to him a little bit because he's got a problem with speeding and I can't use him on the road. He looked like that, and he had, frankly, I don't think he had ever seen that text before in his life. You would obey the governing authorities, that they do not bear the sword in vain, that if you do good, you do not need to fear them. I don't think his reaction to me was blank. Yesterday in conversation with Joel and him, I threw out, have you heard the story of Saul and Samuel? No. Blank. And after he had left, Joel said to me, Daddy, how can that be? How can that be? I said, Joel, we're a rare family who opens our Bible every night. You're a rare young man that has the Bible read to him after lunch or breakfast. This young man's never had an hour sermon in his life. You know the stories that Pastor Chansky starts with? That's all he gets. His church life has been the Book of Virtues. I love the Book of Virtues. But it has no power in it. We live in a society of ignorant people, ignorant of the truth. And how are we going to deliver them? How are we going to hold them back? We're going to have to live truth. And then, we're going to have to speak truth. Simply. We're going to have to take the joke or the little thing they say, and at the right time, touch it. Address it. Beg them not to go on doing it.
don't go on that weekend thing with your girlfriend. Oh, hold them back. So that phrase there, that when he says, nay, if we see any through ignorance, and you look at the top one there on the lost, and this is huge, exposing themselves to danger. If you see any fallen in distress, as travelers upon the road, ships at sea, or any of the like, it is our duty, though it be with peril to ourselves, to hasten, to help, to bring help to them, and not forbear to deliver them, not to be slack or remiss or indifferent in such a case. Classic example would be Esther, right? I will go to the king. Whatever will be, will be. She put herself at risk. Now, that's on the grand scale, but I think, again, each of us face it on the small scale daily. Because what's at risk is our clean reputation, our silence, our safety. Maybe a little bit of uncomfortableness, because I know what happens in the workplace if you speak. It's not always received. And there can be an awkwardness that follows that conversation for days, weeks, possibly forever. You will be avoided. Note 2, in answer to the excuse that is commonly made for the omission of this duty, thou wilt say, behold, we knew it not. We were not aware of the imminence of the danger the person was in. We could not be sure that he was innocent, nor did we know how to prove his innocence, nor which way to do anything in favor of him, else we would have helped him. Can you hear yourself say that? How many times have I not said that to myself? Oh, I would have, if I only would have known, right? Now, it is easy to make such an excuse as this, sufficient to avoid the censures of men, for perhaps they cannot disprove us when we say we knew it not, or, how about this, we forgot. And the temptation to tell a lie for the excusing of a fault is very strong when we know that it is impossible to be disproved. The truth lying wholly in our own breast. As when we say, we thought so and so and really designed it. Which no one is conscious of but ourselves. I think as we read this, each of you know possibly someone who you need to speak to. And you've been avoiding it. It is not so easy with such excuses to evade the judgment of God and into the discovery that we lie open and by determination of what we must abide. Now notice, God ponders the heart and keeps the soul. He keeps an eye upon it. He observes all the motions of it. Its most secret thoughts and intents are all naked and open before Him. It is His prerogative to do so, and that in which He glories. God searches the heart. He keeps the soul. He holds it in life. This is a good reason why we should be tender. It's quite a word. Why we should be tender of the lives, and we'll add the souls of others, and do all we can to preserve them, because our lives have been precious in the sight of God. And He has graciously kept them. Right? If we've been kept from sin and folly, was it our wisdom? So you've got a few bucks in the bank.
Who gave you the skill to attain it? Who gave you the wisdom to keep it? Who's given the opportunity to you, the talents? Who's kept you strong? He knows and considers whether the excuse we make be true or false, whether it was because we did not know it, or whether the true reason was not because we did not love our neighbor as we ought, but were selfish. And regardless both of God and man, let this serve to silence all our frivolous pleas by which we think to stop the mouth of conscience when it charges us with the omission of plain duty. Does not he that ponders the heart consider it? He will judge us accordingly. As his knowledge cannot be imposed upon, so his justice cannot be biased. But he will render to every man according to his works, not only the commissions of evil works, but the omission of good works. And frankly, brethren, I think as we grow a little older in the faith, we, I hope, do better and better on the caring for the commission of evil works, don't we? Well, I don't do this, and I don't do that. I don't do this, and I don't do that. Well, that's good. Well done. But I think that's when the weight of maybe the omissions begin to push us so that we don't get content on reaching our comfortable level of morality. Because now we're acceptable in the eyes of man. In this place and elsewhere. I'm not sure if we're going to go to bridges. I want to talk about a problem that we have, I think, when it comes to these thoughts. I think the problem that we have, at least that I have, is, I'll call it a technology problem in the year 2007. And maybe this is where I would try to help us. I think we have an overload that takes place in our day. An overload, I'll call it a tragedy overload. Right? We watch the news, and every night there's a murder. There's a car wreck. There's a, you know, we see it on the way home. And all these things. We hear about the train wreck in California and the ferry sinking in India. Right? And every day we hear these. And I'll call it compassion burnout. Frankly, the bowels, the scripture that sticks with the bowels of our heart, they just get wrung out after a while. There's a compassion burnout. We use it in a bad way. We use the word desensitization, right? That the bad things of the world, we become desensitized to it. Well, even these things, we become desensitized because our heart can bleed just so much. And we can only be moved by compassion just so much. And frankly, right? And I know how it goes. You send one check, and then what happens? Right? So you think of even the things that we try, and I think rightfully so, to present in this place on a Wednesday night. And some of the men that we've had here from different places. Now, the Jyoti comes to mind from India because he's sending me emails. And we had the opportunity as a family to take him up to the ferry and send him on his way. So think about that. And I don't know what to suggest on the practical level. There may even be, for you news watchers, maybe there's a time to stop watching the news or to watch it every other night. I don't know. I think, again, of our children, okay? And our children keep seeing this and seeing this and seeing this and hearing this and hearing this. And frankly, how much can we take before we see someone alongside the road and he's bleeding and it's just like,
You know, well, so I have a couple of suggestions. One is, as a family or as a home, become focused. For your kids or for your home. And my thought is, focus on one thing locally. Focus on one thing nationally. And focus on one thing worldwide. And then teach your children, teach your wife, educate yourself about that thing. Let's say it's the Lakeshore Pregnancy Center. A great opportunity to take your kids downtown, okay, and to visit this place. For us, that's why we like the Life Walk. It takes something that's out there and we are able to bring it into the lives of our children. It's not just happening. We can talk about 1.2 million. But until you put something physical to that, it's a sin and a tragedy that doesn't even have a face, does it? It's got no face to it. But if we did one thing locally, and the beauty of this is, and that's why I don't want to make this a pro-life thing, we as the people of God gives us different concerns and passions. And that's how the work and the needs of the world are met. If we all got excited about Jyoti, right, then he would be cared for and someone else would be neglected. If we all cared about the orphanage in China, she probably could not get enough from us. But again, I think that's the beauty of the people of God and the church of God, that there should be enough of us to spread ourselves around if we have compassion. If we take a verse like this and say, oh, hold them back, who am I going to hold back and where? How can I apply myself? Where has God given me a burden? Maybe it's the mission downtown. Then go there. Go there on a Friday night. Have your children around those people so they get a burden for that. But then maybe we shouldn't keep burdening them with this and burdening them with this until we and our children burn out. And then we just go, it's too big, we can't touch it. It's just too big. At least that's how I feel sometimes, right? You feel like it's too much, you get too many letters, so what do? You throw them all away? So one thing locally, one thing nationally. So again, our children, ourselves, we've got, if you think of the biblical command, it's for the orphan and the widow. Again, maybe focus on one thing, but my thought is don't just keep piling things on yourself or your children. We'll burn out and we'll lose the sense of compassion that we need. So grab hold of something, grab hold of an area and run with it. And make it useful for yourself and for your home. I'm reading a book right now called Keeping Your Child's Heart by the Maxwells. It's a little bit radical. I've said to Larry, I like radical books. A book that I agree with, I don't do anything with. I just like it because we agreed. But a radical book pushes me. And that's some of the thinking in this Maxwell's book. I would say it was, you know, great. If you disagree with something, fine. But answer the question at least, right? But they're talking about keeping your children's heart. And they're talking about instead of doing all the running around that we're doing as a society with our children, how about thinking about actually taking your family and doing something good? They use the word ministry. Minister. Go to the old people's home. Weekly. You'd be willing to take your child to soccer practice weekly. Why not take them to the old people's home weekly? And cultivate in them compassion. Cultivate in them a usefulness, something that they can put their hands to and actually bring a smile to someone. Have them making something that they can that they can bring to the Lakeshore Pregnancy Center and have the satisfaction of saying, like I talked to my sister, she said, last year at the Pregnancy Center in Oskaloosa, Iowa, there was 259 bags given out, and every one of them had a blanket. And my sister made 259 blankets. And she had the satisfaction of seeing blankets around town. Now imagine if your daughter was walking downtown and she saw one of her blankets on a stroller. That was my sister's experience. 30 miles away in Ottumwa, Iowa, and there is a blanket that her hand stitched. Now you've got something that you've actually done to make a difference. You've expended yourself in a physical way. You've given money to something that is not just out there somewhere, but that you've put your hand to, and maybe your children have seen you put your hand to late at night, to hear the sewing machine running, for dad to hear you doing something out in the garage, not for yourselves, but to actually give it away. Imagine what our children would see if they saw us doing things, going places, and then giving ourselves in some way. There's some verses that I'd like to seal these things with. If you would take this home and maybe spend some time with us this afternoon, I think Bridges is, in some senses, deeper and wider than Matthew Henry. He really addresses the lost issue strongly as a second point. But let's look at a few verses. Matt Nemec, can you look up 1 John 3:17? And Jordan Chansky, can you look up James 4:17? We'll follow those two up together.
Whenever you're ready, Matt.
But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him?
Simple verse. I think we've all heard it before, but apply it, put it as a tag to this Proverbs verse. You say, well, how are we going to deliver those who are being taken away to death? Frankly, sometimes it takes money. I wish that wasn't true. I wish the world didn't run on money. But it does. And I've also heard it said that when we begin to give, we break the grip of the world on our hearts. James 4:17.
Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. It
can almost make you uncomfortable, can it? Again, I'm not trying to bleed you. But I would love to spur you on. I think we live in a broken world. I've said it again and again, and I know you're all seeing it and you're all touching it. But if we're going to hold someone back, again, I think we need to be specific. You need to think about someone when you think about this verse and then put feet to it. A neighbor, a workmate, a brother, a sister, a mom, a dad, be it by ignorance or by wickedness, Matthew Henry said. Whatever is propelling them into the path of danger, and in our day, I think this word staggering is very vivid. Can you see it? Again, I'm a budget dealer, so I see the people stagger in for a truck. Broken homes. Someone without $150 to put down on the truck. Can I get part of my deposit back so I can go fill it with gas?
staggering. Remember the song, "They will know we are Christians by our love, by our love." Yes, they'll know we are Christians by our love. I guess I have this question for you. Do you have any passions? Think of the man next to you at work. Would he, if I talked to one of your workmates and said, "Yeah, you know Larry Larson? I think you work at the post office, right? Anything about Larry Larson that comes to mind?" Would he have anything to say? Luke, I could go right up and down the row, right? Anything that comes out of his mouth? Anything that rubs him raw? Does he have any bandwagon that he's pulling? At least just one? Right? Where he'll speak, where he'll say something? If I know one thing, it's that Matt Potter has a passion about. Do you have a passion for one thing? And again, we're all different. We've all come from different places. We all work in different places. We've all had different experiences. So different things affect us and different things bother us. Good! Then read about it from the Word of God. Educate yourself concerning it so that you can speak with a biblical truth into that area that you would call your passion. I'm passionate about the young people around me. Even when I see their work habits. Fine, then be passionate about that. Help them. Deliver them. Hold them back. Whatever it is. But do you have any passions? Let's close with a couple of statements from Scripture. 1 John chapter 4. Several verses here. I read this to spur us on. 1 John 4. "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." And by the way, we have needs in this church that are unmet. So you don't have to look far. That's why I say begin locally. You begin in Jerusalem, then you go to Judea, then you go to the ends of the earth. "The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. By this the love of God is manifest in us, that He sent His only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be a propitiation for our sins. Beloved, beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and His love is perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in Him and He in us, because He has given us His Spirit. We have seen and testified that the Father has sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in Him and He is in God. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love. And the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because as He is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. Because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because He first loved us. If someone says, now here's where it all boils down, when it all boils out of the pot. If someone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, that the one who loves God should love his brother also. And then a closing word of encouragement, would come from Luke 6, verse 38. Understand this promise and this principle. Give. All right, simple word. Give. And it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. He who sows sparingly will reap sparingly.